السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. All praises are Allah's, Lord of the world. And may His peace and blessings be upon our Master, the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and His pure Immaculate Ahlul Bayt. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad. It's an honor again to be in the presence of you, dear brothers and sisters. Thank you for inviting me again. Inshallah, I'll be speaking for the next 10 nights. The subject which I'm hoping to dissect a bit and explore is a principle of belief that is specific to Shias. Our Sunni brothers don't believe in this article of faith. And that's the concept of Raj'at. It's a very big topic, this. Just in case one or two of you may have not heard of it, the common lay people's understanding of Raj'at is the return, a physical return of good and bad people to this world. And that's okay. And we'll be exploring this dimension of Raj'at too. But there are many other understandings of Raj'at. This common lay person idea of Raj'at that most of us may have, many of the order of thought don't like it. They're uncomfortable with it. Imam Khomeini is one of them. Ayatollah Hassan Zad another. They say it's something else. There are four or five positions on this. This is something very important to know. It also has practical benefits. So that's going to be my main theme, which I'm going to, inshallah, open up. But today, it's only I want to, with your permission, just give an introductory lecture, not on Raj'at. Just in general, covering some of the points we went over during the month of Ramadan, going through them and paving the way for our discussion on Raj'at, inshallah. Okay. If you recall, I did mention and speak about this letter. I think the first lecture I gave when I was here. And Imam Khomeini, he wrote a letter to the then president of the Soviet Union. This was in the late 80s, to Gorbachev. And this letter wasn't just a political letter, it was spiritual political. It's a very, very deep letter. It's worthy to go through it, you know, once every while. There are many delicate points in this letter. And this letter has to be viewed as an invitation to Islam. It was written to the president of the Soviet Union. But it was an invitation to Islam. To who? For the West. Imam's agenda was inviting the West, you know, Western, you know, Christians or non-Muslims in general, to Islam. In this case, they were communists. And it's interesting to see what Imam's approach was. When you want to invite non-Muslims to Islam, what's the way to go through it? What's the way one has to proceed? It's something different. Then one has to ask oneself, why does Imam choose this route of inviting the West to Islam? And in the letter, he says that he wants Gorbachev and people in the West to research and investigate Islam. Why? I quote, "Not because Islam or Muslims are in need of you, but rather to acknowledge that Islam's lofty and global values can constitute the means of comfort and savior for all nations, as well as unknotting humanity's essential difficulties. So this is something, you know, something for the West in general. You want to solve your problems. Islam is the key, but what kind of Islam? This is an Arif speaking now. Now I'm going to read four paragraphs of the letter, and then slowly we'll enter the main discussion for tonight. Imam writes in the letter, "Our innate nature," referring to the fitrah, "pulls us towards acquiring perfection in power and knowledge." See, very eloquently starts this paragraph with a fact which is acceptable, has to be accepted by all peoples of all cultures. Whoever says, "I'm not after perfection," is lying. Everyone is after perfection. It's okay, some people find perfection in a car. They're still after perfection, but due to their limitations in knowledge and faith, they see perfection as having, let's say, XY car. That's okay though, they're still looking for it. This is something innate in all peoples, of all cultures, irrespective of what one's religion is. "Our innate nature pulls us towards acquiring perfection in power and knowledge. Hence, there exists pure power and knowledge for us to have been attracted to it in the first place. And that source of all power and knowledge is Almighty God, to whom we are all heading towards, even if we are not aware of it." So this is the delicate point again, Imam is mentioning. "Even the idol worshipper is traveling towards God, because no one but God can be worshipped. Iyyaka na'abud," we say it every day. The idol worshipper is worshipping the idol, but we're saying only Allah can be worshipped. So even the idol worshipper is worshipping Allah, but he's not aware of it. I can give many other good examples here too, but I'm just afraid that you may misunderstand them. But this example Imam gave himself. "Man wants to reach to absolute truth in order to be annihilated in God. The craving and yearn towards an eternal life is incorporated within us all. And this itself indicates the existence of an eternal cosmos that is death-free." There's no end to this cosmos. Don't think that when we speak of Qiyamah, there's only one Qiyamah and it entails the absolute destruction of the whole solar system, of the whole of Earth, planet Earth. That's not Qiyamah. Even Allama Tabatabawi in Al-Mizan spoken about this. Qiyamah doesn't mean the destruction of everything. There is no end. It keeps on continuing, people after people. Life will always be, always was. This we will open up a bit because it is associated with one of the definitions of Rajat, a position that Ayatollah Hassan Zada has. Then Imam continues, "Assuming your excellency," this is to Gorbachev. Look at the etiquette here. We have to have etiquette when we, you know, speak with people, whoever they are. The etiquette has to be there. You can't be rude or insolent to people just because they're not Muslim. That's wrong. You have to love people. Okay, if associating with X person will be a compromise to your faith, okay, there's no need. But I mean, of course you're much stronger than that. Don't look at yourselves as so weak that you can't learn how to love everyone. Anyway, look at the adab here. "Assuming your excellency," he was a communist, Gorbachev was. assuming your excellency would like to research in these domains, now these domains are Irfani domains, philosophical domains, you can instruct the scholars of such sciences to refer to the writings of Farabi and Avicenna. His first line of course of action here is introducing Farabi and Avicenna, two famous Muslim philosophers about 1,000 years ago. He's introducing these people for them to be invited to Islam. Farabi and Avicenna, may Allah's mercy be upon them, in addition to books on Western philosophy. So have the books on Western philosophy, but also read these two to, you know, broaden your horizons. By doing so, it will become evident that A, the law of causation, cause and effect. Everything has a cause, every cause has an effect, and so on. The law of causation, cause and effect, upon which all forms of knowledge is based, is rational and not sensible. Sensible as in not perceived by the senses. All forms of knowledge are rational, they're intelligible, they're not sensible. Nothing to do with the five senses. And B, the perception of universal meanings and concepts upon which all forms of reasoning depends is also rational in nature and not sensible. Also, you can instruct the scholars of such sciences to refer to the writings of Sohrawardi. See, now the next step. He's introducing Sohrawardi now, another famous philosopher and RF. May Allah's mercy be upon him. Writings of Sohrawardi on illuminationist philosophy, so that they explain to you, when they read it, your scholars, when they read it, they explain to you that the body or any physical existent is in entire need of pure light. Being in entire need is being totally dependent on something existence-wise. Whatever is, whatever exists, any body, any physical existent, is in entire need of pure light, which is sense-free. That pure light you can't perceive with the five senses. And that man's inner witnessing of one's self is totally independent from the senses. When you want to know who you are, the I, the first person singular, when you say, I am writing, I am reading, I am studying, I am, like, my name is written, I am Muhammad or whatever, what is this I? We have one tradition where it says, Zahiruka lilfana. Batinuka ana, God is saying this. That your outer side, your external dimension, is to perish. God is saying this. But your inner side is me. Your inner truth. The witnessing of yourself, if one succeeds, is outside the jurisdiction of the five senses. Furthermore, Imam adds, request your greater scholars and professors. Previously he will say your scholars, now he's saying your greater scholars. That Imam wrote very, you know, with precision, every word, meaning behind it. Request your greater professors to refer to the transcendental philosophy of Mullah Sadra. May Almighty Allah's pleasure be upon him, and may Allah resurrect him with the prophets and the Salihin. Now then, look at how he's, you know, lauding Mullah Sadra now, respecting him, praising him. May Allah resurrect him with the prophets, with the Salihin. The Salihin is a specific station in Irfan, and it's referred to in the Quran too. It's higher than the station of being a prophet alone. It's the highest station of infallibility to be one of the Salihin. Don't only look at it, its external, its literal meaning, which is the righteous. That one, me and you are that. In the Quran though, there are places where it says this prophet didn't become one of the Salihin in this world. They'll become one of the Salihin in the next world. We have this in relation to two prophets. This Salihin isn't just being righteous, because of course all prophets are righteous. Anyway, so here is Mullah Sadra, so that it becomes known to them that verily the truth and reality of knowledge, the truth of knowledge, is an immaterial existence, and all forms of thought are matter-free, and therefore are not governed by the laws of physics or material rules and laws. Why does Imam, you know, this is Mullah Sadra now, he's just giving why it's important to read Mullah Sadra. To understand that the essence of knowledge, the truth of knowledge, is immaterial. So what? Why is that important? Because you are your knowledge. Now we're getting closer to witnessing the essence of what you are. Knowledge and actions depending on your knowledge, of course, build who you are. You are your intentions. The knowledge builds you existentially. Your spirit is a function of your knowledge. Your body, after this physical world, which is only, what follows is only metaphysical realms of existences. There's a body in every realm of existence, but it's not a physical body. In Barzakh, heaven, hell, it doesn't have to be a physical body, but there is a body. That body is a construct of your actions, which depends on knowledge. The essence of what you are is something immaterial. You are what you know. You are your intentions. So you are an immaterial reality. So it's important to appreciate this. So he mentions Mullah Sadra. I shan't tie you further, Imam adds, and shall not name books of the Gnostics, the Urafa, especially those of Muhyiddin ibn Arabi, because assuming you desire to be informed of the discussions and writings of this great personality, now before he would say, for your scholars to read these books, or your greater professors to read these books. But with Muhyiddin ibn Arabi, and with the Urafa in general, things differ now. He says, assuming you desire to be informed of the discussions and writings of this great personality, you must send a number of your genius specialist experts who have a strong basis in such matters to Qom. This was in 1989. To understand Ibn Arabi, you have to send them to Qom now. And not only your scholars, your greater professors, no, your genius specialist experts who have a strong basis in these matters. You have to send them to Qom, so that after several years, with reliance upon Allah, with tawakkul upon Allah, they can become aware of the depth and thinner than hair delicateness of the stations of Gnosis, Irfan. For without making such a journey, awareness of such knowledge is not feasible. See. Now, at that time, in Qom, many thought Ibn Arabi was kafir, unfortunately. And there was a minority who believed he was a Sunni Muslim. That's the best it got in all. So many were very disappointed with this letter, as you could imagine. Now, whether Ibn Arabi was a Sunni or a Shia, it doesn't matter. One's lost the plot here a bit. But Ayatollah Jawadi Amali, Ayatollah Hassan Sadr Amali have proved beyond doubt that he was a Shia. There's no doubt about it. Some people just read one or two extracts here and there, they hear it here and there, and then they come to conclusions. This man has written 800 books. This is an area that you can't come to a quick conclusion like that. And who are we to, you know, label people like that? Go and study for years, acquire that merit before you make say such a thing. But this has been proved. But since it's not important, I don't really want to go into, you know, proving such a thing. But look how Imam, how he saw it important to invite the West to Islam. This was the peak of Islam. This layer, this dimension of Islam, he regarded as important. And then, at the end, Imam writes in the letter, "Finally, allow me to explicitly announce that the Islamic Republic of Iran, as the largest and most powerful headquarters in the Islamic world, can easily fill the doctrinal vacuums of your system and state." You see, that's how he saw it all, how comfortable he was with everything. Okay. Now, why was the route that the Urafa have taken, why was Imam stressing on that? As something to introduce to the West. This I want to suggest one or two things here that maybe Imam was referring to that. I'm not saying Imam said this route I'm suggesting here. I'm not quoting Imam anymore. That was the letter. But I want to suggest one or two routes that the Urafa in general, especially Ibn Arabi, they do when they explain religion that other experts in other realms of Islam, they don't pay as much attention to it. One has to understand that one's approach to the theoretical dimensions of religion is essential to one's growth. You have to know your religion properly. I'm not saying those who only have a very external and minimum understanding of the religion won't grow spiritually. I'm not suggesting that at all. Rather, I'm trying to say that Islam is a religion with an outer surface which is important and which is a first step. But in addition to that, there are layers and layers and layers of esoteric inner meanings to Islamic texts. It's infinite. And that's why some traditions speak of, with every verse, there are 70 esoteric meanings, 70 esoteric dimensions, butun. Some traditions speak of 70,000 esoteric dimensions to every verse. Some traditions speak of every word has 70 dimensions to it. Something incredible. But even if we were to enter and explore and enter that territory of the butun, we have to sort out the outer aspect first. That doesn't mean that we have to only speak about the outer dimension of Islam and just ignore the esoteric dimensions, the inner dimensions, the internal dimensions, the bhutun. Some people may come to me and say, look, people, the people you're speaking with, they haven't even handled the outer side of religion, and you're speaking about the irfani things. I don't like that too much. I mean, it's not a very good way to do tabligh. You know, I've come from Iran. If all you want is for me all this way to come and just give you a few ahkam and some rulings, I think you deserve much more. There are many people here. You have the school here, for goodness sake. They're teaching the children. At least they're teaching the outer aspect of religion, and they're teaching it well. Sabah Academy is doing a very good job. But don't expect me to just to focus on that. My audience, there's a wide spectrum here of people. Everyone will be satiated to the degree and their capacity. So, there's an exoteric and esoteric knowledge of religion. The aim of the esoteric side of religion, and the esoteric side of religion is one reality, but it has many dimensions to it. Esoteric here, by esoteric, I mean the butun, the inner aspects, the inner dimensions. But the aim of esoteric Islam, the aim of Irfan, the aim of Sufism, is for us to live and breathe Islam, not only when we die, confining these aspects to after death, not to breathe Islam or live Islam one day in the future, not to be in wait of it, not to wait for its rewards and so on and so forth, but to breathe Islam moment to moment in this world onwards. That's the aim. From moment to moment. Now, don't be scared. Even I don't breathe Islam moment. Nothing to be scared about. Just learn it. See what they want to, where they want to take you with this. And then everyone to their own capacity. No one can do this within a day, a week, a year. Just take it slowly. Just try to understand it first. Our aqa'id, Islamic doctrine, is called the major fiqh, fiqh al-akbar. This fiqh of ahkam is the minor fiqh. Aqaid is much more important. You have to learn both of them, and it's okay to learn both of them at the same time. It's okay. Aqaid is much more important. You have to instill tawheed within you so that your ahkami actions, your salat, your fasting, bears any result whatsoever. It all depends on how you've installed aqa'id within yourself, how you've understood tawheed, how you've understood resurrection, how you've understood prophethood, imamat, and so on and so forth. If your understanding of tawheed is deficient, you can do salat as much as you want. It'll be of no effect. I mean, the minimum amount of salat, 5 times a day, it's a minimum. Everyone has to do that. But I'm saying even more than that. You do all the mustahab salats, for example. But if you haven't sorted out this aqaid, all these external actions, such as salat, fasting, hajj, it's all a means of harvesting the seeds of aqa'id. So you have to have, they have to be implanted within you, so that those physical actions then produce the harvest. If nothing is implanted within you, if the seeds of true tawheed, do salat as much as you want, go to Hajj every year, but it will have no effect. Now this aqa'id, this doctrine, has an outer side to it, which is important. Everyone has to know about it. But it has layers and layers of esoteric dimensions. Incredible. And actually, for you to succeed, to explore those layers, you have to master the outer aspect of religion. The outer aspect of both ahkam and aqa'id. So, here with Irfan, the aim, and I'll tell you how they want to do it, but the aim is for everyone to breathe Islam, not once a year in Hajj, not biannually on the two Eids, for example, not every week Friday prayer, not every day five times a day only, to breathe Islam moment to moment to moment. Now, expecting anything less than breathing Islam from moment to moment to moment, expecting anything less than that. Now, in practice, we may fail. I fail, you fail. It's okay. Everyone is treading along the way. So, as long as we're on the path, though, even if we only fulfill 5% of the way, since we're on the path, though, that's very good. It's better than not even appreciating or acknowledging it. So expecting anything less than this is doing two things. First, it's limiting your vision of Islam, and it's also wasting yourself. Just wasting it, day after day after day. Islam says Hajj once a year. Once a week, Friday prayer. Salat, five times a day, okay. But then the Quran speaks of, in Salat, الَّذِينَ هُمْ عَلَى صَلَاتِهِمْ دَائِمُونَ. Those who are permanently in their prayer. Now, it doesn't mean that the prayers, the fiqhi prayers that we do. That's five times a day. And if you want to do all the nafilis, that's also limited. It won't take more than an hour if you can. But here the Quran is speaking about those who are in prayer permanently. See here, this is one of the aims of Irfan here. It wants you to breathe Islam permanently, moment to moment to moment. Now, I want you to look at a few routes and methods that the Sufis incorporate and how they look at things. Now, don't be scared of the word Sufi. We spoke about this last time. And Arif. That's all we mean. Don't panic. Okay, there have been Sufis who have done bad things, have abused Islam. That's okay. Sufism is a science, like medicine. Medicine's a science. There are many malpractices, many abuses that doctors have done. No one says medicine, you know, is bad, or no one gets scared when they hear the word medic. Sufism is a science. Science of tariqah. Science of getting to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Like every other science, Sufism has its own principles. And like every other science, it has its sources from which it extrapolates its principles. Now I want to go through 6 or 7 key areas of Islam and just raise questions. I'm not going to cover them. I'm only going to cover one of them. I covered one or two during the month of Ramadan, and in the next 10 days I'm only going to cover one of them. First, the question of death. Is it for the eight? This is questions that the Sufi asks. Is it for the aged alone? How many different types of death are there? What does it mean to die from moment to moment to moment? Most of us just see death as something happening after a number of years, we all die. But I mean, erfahren death right now. We have to plan to die from moment to moment to moment. Because death means the transition from one realm to a higher realm. That's all that death means. Mort is different to fort. Fort involves destruction, perishing of something. When we die, the I is still present. The I still persists. Now this is the death that the Quran speaks about. The Quran only speaks about mort. Never speaks about fort. Death is a transition from one realm to a higher realm. A more particular understanding of what death is the degree of nearness you acquire to Allah. The nearer and nearer you become to Allah, with every nearness that arises, you die. Then you become alive again. You die. Then you come. That route to getting to Allah. Then we have something called voluntary death. Nothing to do with physical suicide. That's haram. Spiritual suicide is okay. Forgive the term. Killing the ego to get closer and closer to Allah. Usually what happens is when we all die, after 60, 70, 80 years or whatever, we enter into barzakh. But the voluntary death is when we're in this world and we enter into barzakh whilst alive in this world. Death qualifies. And we get higher and higher into heaven, sea, hell, everything. This is what, when you see the term voluntary death, is when people living in this world acquire that capacity to ascend to Allah. They're awake in this world, but they ascend to higher realms. You don't have to die a physical death to enter heaven and hell. You can enter heaven whilst in this world. That's the essence of death. So Israeli forces, one of the angels called Israeli forces are at play from moment to moment. Depends on how you act. Israel doesn't only come when you're at an old age, he comes and takes you away. Even in that transition from one realm to a higher realm, it's Israeli forces at play here. This concept of voluntary death, this concept of death, that ascending from one realm to another realm, if you understand this properly, will you understand Messianism properly? Otherwise, in Mahdaviyat, terms like Qiyam, Intidhar, and Ghaybat will not be truly appreciated if this isn't understood. That intizar, that awaiting that you do for the Mahdi, Ajalallahu ta'ala faraj wa sharif, is Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa Muhammad, will be something very minimal if you don't understand what the essence of death is. It will be something just a minimal understanding. We're waiting. Then we have instructions. Die before you die. Mutu, qabla an tamutu. Die before you have the physical death. Ascend to barzakh, ascend to heaven. Open the soul, unfold it. Before you die a physical death. And then Islam has this equation saying sleep is death's brother. And this is something for you. that sleep and death are brothers, they share a mechanism. Because in our sleep, we all ascend the different metaphysical realms. But in sleep, we come back in this life again. In death, there's no opportunity to return in this physical life, at least. Now, sleep, it's a virtue. Having dreams is a virtue. Allah communicates with people, speaks with people, be it through angels or other sources. It's open to everyone. It needs a pure soul, though, for the dream to have meaning. Now, this is the question of tamathulat, which we spoke in some depth last time. I won't repeat it here, but in relation to one of the dimensions of Rajat, I'm going to return to tamathulat, because it's the key to understanding Rajat. But there too, it's in dreams, in apparitions, in visions, whether you're asleep or you're awake. Those who are stronger in spirituality, they even have those visions when awake. Usually we have it when we're asleep. Because when we're asleep, we detach from the worldly life automatically. But when we're awake, it's very difficult to detach from the worldly life. That's why rarely we see it. Now, some people who experience extreme burdens, extreme illnesses, or take hallucinogenic drugs, for example, yes, they do detach themselves from the world life, and they do have visions, but they're not pure. But it's the same mechanism, though. The purer the soul, the purer the apparitions. Then they speak about barzakh. Is barzakh to follow physical death period? Or does it exist now? Can it be experienced before physical death? And if so, how? Is barzakh in our own hands? Yes. We're building our barzakh from action to action whilst in this world. It's a dimension of the soul. The soul is infinite. The potential of your souls is to attain to Allah's essence, to acquire unity with Allah. Depending on how much you want to ascend, barzakh, heaven, hell, these are all constructs of your actions, which will be manifested in the hereafter. But some people can see it in this world. Is it physical? Or is it immaterial? And how does it differ from one's dreams? Because in our dreams too, we enter into barzakh, everyone. We enter into more immaterial realms than barzakh. In barzakh, at least, it's semi-immaterial. There are shapes, color, size. There's just no physical matter. These realms of existences too, Allah, become more and more immaterial as you go higher. Dreams can sometimes, and that's usually the case with us, because of what we do during the day, dreams are a result of our own imagination, a product and construct of the brain. Dreams, true dreams, are when you detach yourself from the world in life. During the day, you will have pure dreams at night. It all depends how you acted in there. I'm not saying don't go to school, don't go to university, don't have a job, don't marry, have all these things. But one has to detach oneself. This detachment, we spoke about it last time. There's different stages of taqwa. I gave a few examples there. Questioning of the angels. What are angels? Sheikh Tusi calls Iblis an angel. And then some people criticize him, say, well, Sheikh Tusi wasn't right, because in the Quran it says Iblis was one of the jinn. Didn't Sheikh Tusi see that verse? That you feel so, you know, at ease at criticizing someone like Sheikh Tusi. Didn't he see that verse? Malaike, we all regard as angels, that technical definition, and we usually think it's something physical with wings. But Malaike, the literal meaning of it, are forces at play, power. The forces of the cosmos, the force of the other Malaike. The angels aren't something separate, outside Allah's jurisdiction. Allah acts Allah-li from moment to moment in this world. Everything is a result of Allah here. The forces into play when it rains, when the sun shines, when this happens, when we die. Are they physical? With physical voices? So why did no one hear the angels when they revealed the scriptures to the prophets? Or are they immaterial? Then are there degrees to immateriality here? فَتَمَثَّلَ لَهُ بَشَرًا سَوِيًّا. When Archangel Gabriel came as a well-proportioned human being appearing before Lady Maryam alayhi wasalam, was that the angel? That has form, shape. There was no physical matter, but it had some shape. And then we speak of angels in the realm of the intellect. And then there's no shape, color, size there. Are they the same reality, but in different dimensions of existences? Angels, malaika, are forces at play. They're everywhere. Forces of nature, forces of the celestial domain. Israeli forces at play, dying. Moment to moment, everything is dying, coming back to life. The coming back to life, Israfili forces at play. The granting of knowledge, when you see people learning, when you're learning what I'm saying too, when I'm learning what my ustad says, at the nursery, at the schools, everywhere, wherever there's learning, Jibra'ili forces are at play. Every rain which drops, an angel comes. Oh, there's no one sees anything. They're the forces of the cosmos. So can they be seen? And those that were seen, was it with the physical eye or with another eye? Then what form does this questioning take? Is it physical? Will it arise only after physical death, this questioning? Or does the questioning occur even now, from moment to moment? You see how the two perspectives differ here? One is confining it to everything in religion, to after death. Everything will happen. Placing religion on credit, whereas this perspective, every aspect, every article of faith applies right now, from moment to moment. Then they speak about the Sirat, and they usually speak of a physical bridge. Is it something physical? Is it the same bridge for everyone? Does that bridge exist today? Does it exist right now? In Imam Khomeini's letter to his daughter-in-law, after going through a very interesting tradition, which I think I mentioned last time I was here, he said to his daughter-in-law, the Sirat is right here in this world. You're building your Sirat from moment to moment through your actions, which will manifest as a Sirat in another realm of existence after. But the Sirat is here. It's in your hands. You're building it from moment to moment. Then is the Sirat outside the soul? Or is it inside? Is it within you? أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنَا. O you who have faith. لَا يَضُرُّكُمْ مَنْ ذَلَّا إِذَا اهْتَدَيْتُمْ. Now No, actually, I missed a part of it. It first says, Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu alaykum anfusakum. Yes, thank you. Alaykum anfusakum. Observe your souls. You have to observe it. Those who stray can't hurt you if you're guided. But you have to observe the soul. You observe the soul, those who are misguided won't be able to hurt you. Here, Allama Tabatabai has a sensitive extrapolation from here, saying that the sirat is the soul. It all depends on how you're observing it. Then they speak of heaven and hell. We usually just confine it again to it will happen one day, religion on credit. But they speak of heaven and hell right now in this world. You have that capacity. But the understanding of heaven and hell is accepted by all. Now, some people may say it's a physical heaven or hell. Some people say it's immaterial. That's okay. There are differences here. No one becomes a kafir if they believe that hell is something isn't physical. Many believe in that. Or many believe in that. Ayatollah Hasan Zadeh believed in that. And there are many traditions which suggest it too. I mean, they don't just extrapolate it for themselves. There's one tradition where in one of the battles Amir al-Mu'mineen was returning with his companions to the home, and there was a skull. They found a skull on the way. Amir al-Mu'mineen called his companions to bring the skull here. And although the tradition just came to mind, I don't know the particularities of it, but the main feature is this. Amir al-Mu'mineen addressed the skull and said, O skull, who are you? The skull said, I am one of the Persian kings. And my father was a king, and his father was a king. For my becoming a king, I had to do various things to women, and also kill hundreds and thousands of men. And right now, and this voice, who is saying this? The skull wasn't speaking, but the eye was having dialogue. Amir al-Mu'mineen was hearing everything. The others could hear. If me and you were there, we probably wouldn't have heard. It was with Amir al-Mu'mineen's providential walaya that enabled them to hear so that they take lesson. Then this king said, I'm in hell now, and I'm burning. Scorpions biting my body every moment to moment. And it goes into detail of the punishment he's suffering. Now the skull is present there, suggesting it wasn't something physical. But just because it's not physical, if the pain in barzakh or in hell, if we call it an immaterial pain, don't think it's painless. It's much worse than physical pain. You can't compare the two. Physical pain is limited to this physical realm. Pain in those more perfect realms is much worse, in the same way that joy is much better. It's not limited to the physical laws of the cosmos. Well, there's another tradition where Imam Sadiq in Al-Kafi alayhi salam says that people in the beginning, they wouldn't dream. There was nothing known as dreams in the beginning of humankind. And then when the prophets of those people would speak about heaven and hell and how to get to heaven and hell, they would always ignore what the prophets would say. and they would just ignore more and more and reject them and do various things to them. And then one day, throughout one period of time in history onwards, Allah granted people to dream. He granted them to dream. As I said, you know, entering the Barzakhi realm here and further realms of existences. When they started dreaming, they came to the Prophet of that time. The tradition doesn't mention the name of the Prophet. This is in volume 8 of Al-Kafi. Ayatul Hassan Zadan, Ayatul Jawadami, these people, they speak of this tradition in a lot of depth with a particular agenda in mind. Then they would come to the Prophet and said, "Good grief, what's happened? What are all these images that we've seen?" He said, "This is the heaven and hell I've been speaking about. You see, trying for them to appreciate what Qiyamah is." Anyway, then in heaven and hell, when they're speaking of Iblis coming, whipping or burning, what did this mean? Is it really an external red monster waiting to whip you? And we spoke about this last time. We said there, the rationale of divine punishment is tajassum al-a'mal, just an embodiment of your own actions. Don't blame Allah. It's all a result of your own actions. You're the film director, and the result was negative. And that's, you know, what you get. You reap what you sow. Then, this talk of the Mi'raj. Can we undergo Mi'raj too? Is it something available within us? As-salatu Mi'raj al-Mu'min? Says, of course, yes. We too can undergo the Mi'raj. Now, there are many different opinions on Mi'raj. And it doesn't matter when these different opinions occur. There's no need to panic. These different people have these different understandings of it. Avicenna believed that the physical Mi'raj, there was no such thing. The Holy Prophet was in Mecca the whole time, never exiting Mecca. He doesn't even accept the going to Masjid al-Aqsa. He does, but not in the physical form. And then he uses the tradition that when the Prophet came back, the warmth of his seat was preserved. I've only seen Avicenna with this claim. But then Avicenna says, these are secrets that one shouldn't open up. And he has this treatise on the Mi'raj in Farsi. And after reading it, I went to my ustad once and said, is this something okay for me to preach? Because at the end, Avicenna says, these are secrets. People have to acquire it for themselves. What he meant by Masjid al-Aqsa, what he meant by the Buraq, what he meant by all these things. People have to do the Mi'raj for themselves before they understand it. Anyway, Master said, yes, don't discuss this with people. Have you seen his position? He said it's not worthy, so with your permission, I won't go into that. But other scholars too, Imam Khomeini, Ayatollah Hassan Zadani, they've spoken in a very understanding terms. In Al-Mizan it speaks about it. There were different stages to the Mi'raj. It's okay to say in this realm of existence, the physical realm, there's nothing wrong with someone travelling from Masjid al-Haram to Masjid al-Aqsa. But with the other realms, Al-Ramat al-Tabawi is very explicit. When all the prophets are praying behind the Holy Prophet of Islam in Masjid al-Aqsa, and he says, no, how can they? It can't be physical. if you regard those praying of the prophets behind the holy messenger as physical, you'll fall into the trap of reincarnation. They've passed away now. I'll speak more about this because it's related to Rajat. It happened at night. What does night mean? How can we ascend at night? Then in chapter 43, verse 45, وَاسْأَلْ مَنْ أَرْسَلْنَا مِنْ قَبْلِكَ مِنْ رُسُلِنَا, to the Holy Prophet. He's saying, ask those who we sent before you amongst the messengers. But there was no, the last messenger was 500 years before the Holy Prophet. So which messengers were these? But there were messengers. He was speaking with the messengers. The messengers all prayed behind him. But not in the physical realm. It was all in the barzakhi realm. And then there are even higher realms of Mi'raj. The story of the Mi'raj has to be explored carefully. Then Messianism, Mahdaviyat. If I just finish this, so we start with Rajat tomorrow. We've passed our limit. Messianism, what does the reappearance mean? Is it all about only the physical advent? The physical coming of the Imam, is that it? So if that was to take place in 100,000 years' time, how is that going to benefit us? How is the physical coming of the Mahdi going to benefit us? I mean, this, it's an article of faith, something that we believe in wholeheartedly, but if it's going to be only the physical aspect of it, how will that benefit us? How are we to benefit from it today? Are there ways to see the Imam right now in this world? And if there are ways, must they all only be physical? And if it is physical, so what's the point of him going into occultation then? It's purpose here. He doesn't want to be seen physically. Here, the concept of ghaibat is important now. I won't be touching on this here. I just want to raise these, but we too can go into ghaibat. It's a station of Irfan though. And then through that, we see the Imam, but not the physical Imam. It's possible to see the physical Imam, but what benefit is that? To see the physical Imam, there's no virtue in that. Maybe thousands of people are seeing the physical Imam every day, but they didn't know it's the Imam. There's no virtue in seeing him. Many people saw the Holy Prophet. But to become ghaib, to become unseen yourselves, there you see the mithali Imam, and that grants benefit to you. You too have to undergo a ghaibat in order to acknowledge ghaibat. Although, I've just mentioned these, it requires, you deserve more. Maybe I'll mention one or two things. What does intizar mean? How must we wait for the Imam? Is it only the physical waiting? Well, that, most of us won't ever get there. And when, maybe 99.999% of humanity from the time of Adam alayhi salam to the time of the physical reappearance, well, we're not going to see him. Unless you believe that you will return in the physical form. And that's what Rajat is. But then that will encounter a set of different problems that we have to explore. And then finally, Rajat. And this is what I'm going to be speaking about in the next 9 or 10 days. This Rajat, which means return, has many meanings. The popular understanding amongst the common lay people is that at the time of the coming of the Mahdi, when he comes in physical form, many pious and many evil people will also come back alive. I'm not saying that's the correct thing or the wrong thing yet. This has to be explored. It may have faults in it. The faults have to be answered, if it's answerable. The theologians say one thing, the Orafot don't like it, they bring another interpretation to it. Even amongst the theologians, there are many different divisions here. What are the esoteric dimensions of Rajat? We'll discuss that. And then this Rajat, instead of limiting it to one day in the future, the physical coming of the Mahdi, which may be in 100,000 years' time, how can we undergo Rajat right now in this world, moment to moment? See, this is what the Arif is looking for. What's the philosophy of Rajat? Amir al-Mu'mineen said, Fustu wa rabbika al-Ka'bah. Wa rabba al-Ka'bah. Indeed, I've acquired salvation by the Lord of the Ka'bah. Then you want to bring Amir al-Mu'mineen back to this world in the physical form again, the same story happening. And then we say, why is Amir al-Mu'mineen, does he have to come back? Then you say, to take revenge on Ibn Muljim. Ibn Muljim will return. For goodness sake, Amir al-Mu'mineen said, Fustu wa rabba al-Ka'bah. Amir al-Mu'mineen forgave Ibn Muljim. He's forgiven him. He forgave him right there in this world. What do you mean he's coming to give revenge against? See, these have to be explored a bit. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying we have to refine our definitions. Is Rajat physical? If it is, the question of reincarnation has to be answered. If it's not physical, then how is it? How will it be brought about? And other questions like that. And finally, Ashura. I'll end with this, with the permission. Although every night I'll read a few words of burden, musiba, but not tonight with your permission, but from tomorrow night. Ashura here too. Our look on Ashura is important. It's the story of the soul. The essence of Ashura is the story of man. Something happened 1,400 years ago. It's very important too. It's very important to revive everything, even the external aspect of Ashura. It's important. But the essence of Ashura, just don't be oblivious to the essence of Ashura. The story of man, the story of the soul, the limits to which man can raise himself, elevate towards. It's for our benefit to see what levels of Iman we can reach. The whole Maqtal, the whole story, the massacre of Karbala, just shows different dimensions of faith, different than that we can acquire. For some people, it's death is sweeter than honey for me. This is the story of Qasim ibn Hassan, alayhi salam. It's important. We have to reach that stage of that Qasimi stage of faith. Karbala wants us to become Qasim-like. How can we reach that stage where death is sweeter to us than honey? Another level is Ma ra'aytu illa jamila. This killing, there's a massacre going on. People have died in the worst conditions. Lady Zainab says, I see nothing but beauty here. Allah's beauty. This is also another station. It's higher than the Qasimi station now. Another station that man can acquire. It's all story of the soul. Karbala is a story of the soul. The limits of the soul, where we can, the limits of Iman we can acquire. Whatever she saw beauty. The actions were all sins. She only saw Allah. In the realm of the Sharia, yes, those actions were sins. She would say that is wrong in the realm of the Sharia. She has to. She has to tell people, not everyone is like Lady Zainab, alayhi salam. She has to tell them this is wrong. For history to record it one day, for people to know. But then when we come to the spiritual levels of Zainab, alayhi salam, there, now she's speaking to herself. She's disclosing her true Zainabi self. We can become Zainabi too. Whatever she saw Allah. Because all actions are from Allah. But we get drowned in the external aspect of the actions. At-tawhido isqatul izafat. You take the additional aspects away from any action. You're seeing Allah acting alone. That person is sinning and it's a bad action. But there are people with that Zainabi station, even any action they see the beauty of Allah in those actions. They see much further than just the external side. Because all actions return to Allah. You can't, make these independent from Allah. Then these people, they, even at times of war, they still love their enemies. Imam Hussein alayhi salam offered Shim, offered him a guarantee of intercession. Just repent, you see. If we would see Shim, we would just, maybe swear at him. He's going to do the final blow now, because we get drowned in the external side. It's a bad action, but we see that bad action, core bad action, and we fail to see Allah. Whilst they see the Sharia side, the badness of it from a Sharia level, but they're never oblivious to Allah. Of course, they would forgive their imams. Uhur, Hazrat Uhur, suddenly he says, I see heaven on one side, I see hell on the other. This was an apparition. He would see it. Not the physical heaven or hell. But he would see the reality of heaven and hell. You be whore like, this will open up to you. Every individual in Karbala, there's a story behind it. It's a station of spirituality behind it. You have to learn from it. The throwing of the blood into the skies. What was the reason? And many things like that. Okay, I think I've gone over time. I think the microphone is also trying to say something too. So inshallah, from tomorrow, next tomorrow I'll do words of wasimah. Wa sallallahu ala Muhammad.